one could reach them. Then a leak of poisonous gas put them to sleep. There weren't anything left to do. No way to rescue them except to cover the tomb and have a preacher hold a burial service at the face of the mine. Now, I ain't departing this earth and leaving my two girls to the likes of what the greedy man's leaving in our hills. Pa jutted out his chin. I warmed at him, including Honey as his, and was touched at how easily the babe had grown on him and tamped his moodiness the last 2 weeks. She'd brought a light into our dreary home and heavy hearts. And the warmth of it all had given me a peace like no other. Still, my belly knotted when he talked stubborn and scary like that. Pa, it ain't right you working yourself up so. We could go to the city, to Philadelphia. They have fine doctors who care for coloreds.
Enough. I promised your mother.
He coughed for a bit more, the anger attacking his lungs. I plopped down into the chair. Pa, I turned the conversation. Who would want to marry a blue? A blue with a blue baby? I clasped my cold, fearful hands, folding them into my skirts. It can't be anybody good. Pa cringed, and his gray eyes rested over on the creek. I don't want to leave my home. Leave you, I said.
Cussy.
He sighed and dropped into the chair.
It is I who must leave you. The doc says I'm not in good health.
We'll go to Lexington and get better medicine. To a real city hospital. Please, Pa, let me stay and care for you.
This place ain't fit for you and Honey.
I can provide for my own babe, and I don't need a husband to do that. I have my books. His voice thickened.
You and the child deserve better. Deserve what I couldn't give you and your mama.
Who could give us better? Who would want to? Even the homeliest white woman is prettier than me. To them, I'm a blemish, Pa, an outcast. Pa, please look at me.
He wouldn't,
but I saw his reddening eyes, the color peeking under his coal-stained grimace. There's only a handful of eligible men left in town, I said quietly. Most of them already turned me down. The others are too scared. His shoulders dipped a little.
I have to see that you and the babe are cared for.
I pressed him again. Who would marry a blue? Who? In the distance, someone whistled lightly, toppling a horse's whinny. The tune trickled softly through the pines, down the singing waters and across smooth rock.
That one,
Pa said, and raised his pointy chin toward the creek. He picked up his hat and lunch bucket, whisked out a good night, and was down the steps and off to the mine. Over in her stall, Junior brayed and blew warnings, hawing long bellows. I leaned over, listening to the quarter's faint melody growing stronger, pressing my angry hands on the railing and then over my ears. I grabbed the courting candle off the table and tossed it out into the yard. The saucer danced violently in the air, then shattered on rock, sending the candle loose and tumbling, my signal that I was not available. I'd tell Pa the quarter lit off when he got a closer look at me. I sat back down and hummed a tune of my own, studying my hands, watching as they faded into a soft, misty blue. Chapter 44. Like the warmth of winter candlelight cast across a beloved, worn book, he was. What he did was blazing with boldness when Jackson Lovett plucked my courting candle out of the dirt, carried it up the porch, and stuffed it into his pocket that night.
"Cussy Mary," he'd said, "I'll be needing this for my daughter when she gets her first quarter."
I stood. "You?" From behind his back, he pulled out a fisted posy of pretty blue-eyed Marys.
"If you and Honey'll have me."
There was a promise in his voice, hope in his eyes, and a lick of stubbornness in his face. "Me and my babe have ourselves everything we need right here, Jackson Lovett." With his other hand, Jackson reached out and took mine. I pulled it free and turned away, afraid, crossing my ugly blue hands under my arms, afraid of the feelings running through me. From her stall, Junia nickered into the coming night. Out in the yard, Jackson's steed blew back. Frogs and other night critters trilled and beckoned the cooling darkness, rolling into my discomfort. Jackson set the wildflowers on the wood railing, circled to face me, gently clasping my hands. "I ain't accepting charity, Jackson." I untangled our hands again and turned to go inside. "I don't need it. I have myself a respectable position, a proper life with my books, and I will make it a good one for me and honey." I grabbed the door latch. "Cussy Mary." He stepped closer, put a finger under my chin, seeking my eyes, trying to lock us together. "The WPA makes exceptions for married women now, and I'll see to it you get permission to tote books. You and those books are a shining light for our people. For me." I'd heard, but still I pushed him away with mistrustful eyes. "I read the paperwork," Jackson said, "despite those ladies down at the library center who were none too helpful when I told them why I wanted to. For you." I could see Harriet's and Eula's pinched, confused faces, their reddening cheeks and tight-fisted envy. "Cussy, I went to your papa and sought his permission to give you a proper courtin', to ask for your hand." Wide-eyed, I spun to face him. You went to Pa?" I asked, surprised Pa hadn't gone to him to wheedle a courtship. "Sure enough. The first time after you brought those books to my hill. The second was after I saw you at the library center. There was a third after a certain mule ate your flowers." He cleared his throat. "A fourth and fifth. Your Pa turned me down 6 times in all." 6 times. He held up 6 fingers, wiggling them, and shook his head. 6? And there wasn't going to be a 7th, and I had to explain just that to Elijah Carter. He said firmly, "Same as I did with those fussy library ladies at the center when they tried to keep the paperwork from me."
"Why would you marry a blue?"
"I told your papa I love you, and I'm telling you now, and I'll damn sure nail that surety to every Kentucky crag, post it on every town door. I love you, Cussy Mary. And I will love our children. Blue or white, it matters none."
Forever, I'd let the darkness and brokenness live inside. Let others keep it there. His words were as fine as any prayer, and I wanted so bad to fall into his arms and get the salvation. But after accepting for so long what other folks thought of me, it was easier, safer not to.
"I promised your papa I would love and protect you and the babe. I promise you this now."
To think that the baby could be safe, protected, was what every Kaintuck mama longed for in this wild, unforgiving land. Still, I had my route, my books, and I felt a safeguard, a necessity in those treasures, and found my own strength like no other.
"I give you my word, my absolute love," he said. "Cussy."
I placed a steadying hand on the splintered board of the old cabin where I'd been born, raised by my folks, the one who was no longer here, and the ill one who barely remained. "No, Jackson, I can't. I won't leave my Pa sickly and alone."
"There's room on the mountain for Elijah. All of us."
Ever so gentle, he ran a thumb over my cheek. The pain of poverty, years of shame, scorn, and loneliness paled, and I tried to break free and grasp the hope, embrace this wonderful, odd sentiment called love.
"I love you. You. And I mean to be the good man you deserve and promise to become the better man that you'll make me. I want to sit by the hearth every night, read to our young'uns, and grow old together. Please."
He held out his palm, waiting, his words wrapped in a strangeness I'd never heard.
"Cussy Mary, be my bride and leave this dark hollow. Come up to the mountain with me."
In that moment, I looked into his eyes and knowed he meant the tender words, every one of them. And I knowed I wanted to be on that mountain with him forever. He pulled me to him, pressed the promises onto my lips, setting them afire in roaring reds and oranges.
"For my beautiful book mistress," he whispered, plucking up the flowers and pressing the sky blue and white velvet blossoms into my hands. Weren't a single soul who'd ever breathed words like that to me, ever uttered or saw me as anything other than a color, an ugly color, and said so too, or ever made me hear it as a truth. But Jackson Lovett did. And for the first time in my life, the ugliness vanished, and I felt a light dance in me and rise out of the darkness.
Marry me? He asked.
I heard a pureness in his proposal, the prayer from his heart, and a certainty that he'd been saving it a lifetime, and just for me.
Marry me, Cussie Mary, and I promise to spend every waking breath trying to be worthy of you.
My voice became strangled with tears. I could only nod a feverish yes. Chapter 45. Hours after Jackson left, I couldn't rest. Had to keep moving. Couldn't help marveling at the new feeling of love, its energy. I checked on the baby many times, fed her and changed her cloths. Honey must have felt it all too, because she wouldn't go back to sleep. She wasn't crying or fussing neither. I picked up Millie Molly Mandy and began to read to her. Once upon a time, I flipped open the storybook and stopped. See the girl, honey? I pointed to the picture of the youngin dressed in a frock. Honey blinked and stared at it. Her name is Millie Molly Mandy. I lightly scratched Honey's chubby tummy and she squirmed and cooed. Look at your pretty smart self, I smiled. You're eager to learn all the words. When I finished the first chapter, she closed her eyes and quieted. Out on the porch, I folded diapers and hummed a ditty, the tingle of Jackson's kiss still fresh on my lips. In a bit, I picked up a book on the table and flicked through it. The lantern cast a soft light across my busy fingers, my mind near bursting, picturing the three of us reading together. I'd show Honey my route one day and introduce her to my patrons. I thought of the opportunities the young'un would have, how the Packhorse Library, its books, had opened my eyes to places and folks beyond these hills, breathed a new life now with Jackson. Honey'd have it all. Books will learn you, were Angeline's last words to Honey, and I vowed to give the babe all the books. Give her what dear Angeline wanted, and the dreams I was desperate for her to have. Lighthearted, I shut the book and returned to my task. The tittering neighs of someone's mount brought me back. I looked up from my laundry and saw the ghostly lit lanterns, two mules approaching, and what trailed behind them scraping the ground. The cloth fell to the boards and I slowly rose, swallowing my cheerful thoughts, the fear weighing my legs, stitched tight in my belly. One of the beasts was harnessed with a stretcher. I squinted at the men's dark, drawn faces and flew down the steps, feeling the gallop of my heart reach my ears. Pa? No, Pa! Pa! I ran into the yard and collapsed by the stretcher, shook his shoulders. Pa! Oh, Pa, wake up! I kneeled over him screaming, then shook him, my voice an ugly crackle, strained from pleas to wake his lifeless form, my hands desperate to bring the dead back to life. Please! I clutched his coal-stained shirt, shook harder, clawed at the coarse fabric. The remnants of the mine breathing its last deadly breaths of coal dust into the air. Don't leave me. Wake up and let me tell you about the quarter. Pa, I'm getting married. I grasped his cold, lifeless hand and cradled his coal-stained head with my other one. Pa, oh, Pa. The stick held the fire. I leaned into his face. Took hold fine. And he's a fine one you picked. Pa, don't leave us, I begged. Please don't leave. I laid my wet, burning cheek against his hard, cold one. The beast's nervous brays nickering mingled with my rasping cries, spirited into gusts of grieving winds that plucked at the houseboards, old chinks and window cracks, carrying bursts of the night madness through pines. Ma'am? A man's soft voice called above. I peered up as the coal miner dismounted and approached with a lantern. Ma'am. Miss Cussie, I'm Howard Moore.
Mighty sorry to be bringing him home like this. He grimaced and shook his head, squeezed his red eyes shut. We was pulling pillars tonight. It was one of the most dangerous jobs of a coal miner, one that most shirk from. The company's last job, where the men took out the pillars of coal that held up the roof of the tunnel to keep the top of the mountain from collapsing. Elijah got trapped. Mighty sorry. Mr. Moore set down the lantern, played with the carbide helmet a second. He brushed off the coal dust on Pa's lamp, then held it out. Your pap was one of the best, ma'am. Volunteered to pull pillars with me when no one else would. A good, hard-working man who took care of us all. He made me get out first. Insisted. Then I couldn't find him at the mouth. By the time I got back to him, he weren't long for this world. The miner choked and rubbed a tight fist across his coal-stained mouth. I held Elijah's hand, and we prayed and talked a few minutes before the Lord took him. He will be sorely missed and will cast a long shadow over these old Kentuck mountains. Soft murmurs of the other men echoed the miner's. He wiped Pa's hat on his sleeve, handed it to me, and I clutched it to my cheek, pressed the sooty helmet to my trembling lips. The miners trudged up the hill to our small family cemetery and dug hard into the night. Later, when I heard them talking softly on the porch, I peeked out and saw them pass and drink. A coal miner's tradition. One or more would stay with the body, keep watch over their fellow miner. Never leave the dead man to face his last earthly moments alone until he was tucked good and safe into the ground. Around 5 a.m., I heard a horse's high whinny and opened the door. Someone rode into the yard on a horse-drawn cart. I walked out to the porch, raised my lantern, and saw the coffin it carried. Then I saw the man who had ridden it, Jackson. I raced down the porch steps. Jackson jumped down from the wagon and opened his arms, taking me in with his strong clasp. I stopped in town to have a late meeting with Amos Dalton about timber when I heard about the mine accident. I'm sorry, Cussie Mary. I saw the miners leaving for your place. I wanted to help. They chipped in and made sure Elijah would have a fine coffin, and I borrowed the cart from Amos to get it here. We'll see Elijah has a proper burial. Preacher will be out at first light. To have lost Henry and Angeline in such a short time, and now my only parent. The grief spilled forth, swallowing me. Jackson drew me closer, and I buried my face in his chest, and huge sobs racked my body while he held on to me, his arms steady and healing. At dawn, I found Mr. Moore sitting on the grass beside Pa's covered stretcher, while the others were half asleep on the porch. The men roused and told me Jackson had gone off to ride in with the preacher. The sky turned into a gray beast. The winds whipped off hats, plucked at our overcoats, and whistled prayers through the treetops as we laid Pa to rest on the knoll up in our old small Carter cemetery beside Mama and the other blues. Chapter 46. Pa always believed a marriage in the fall would bring a union of rebirth that had bud slow, grow steady and strong from the dying season, while a marriage made in the hot summer would be short-lived and quick to wither. We set our wedding date for October. Honey would be 3 months old, fit and ready to make her first visit to town. I'd bought dress fabric from the dry goods store that had opened after the company store and mine closed down, and used the simple butterick pattern I'd found in a box of library donations at my outpost. The dress hem rested comfortably at my shins. It was a pretty print of golds and chocolates, with a matching sash, a modest scoop neckline, and long, soft sleeves. Perfect. Not too severe, not too prissy. My marriage dress fit the fine fall weather we'd been having. "Ain't that a good-looking dress, child? And these stitches are some of the best I've seen," Loretta declared on her porch, peering through her new spectacles when I showed it off to her. "Why, the fabric's a sure match for the old Tucky Mountains and your special day." The hills had trotted out the boldest colors this autumn, blushed in scarlets, pumpkins, and golds. The dying leaves shimmered in lifting breezes, somehow breathing life into the dying season.
On the morning of October 20, I stood over Pa's grave and thought about him and the days since his passing, his long shadow alive across the slumbering mountains. Pa, I miss you and Mama. It's my wedding day, and I wish you could see it. See how the books brought us together. I am filled with love. Jackson's a good man, the finest. Honey is fit and growing. We're going to be just fine. Fine. You rest in peace now. I laid a hand on my parents' headstone. An hour later, Jackson rode us into Troublesome and parked the little horse-drawn wagon at the post office. Before he helped us down, he held up a finger. I've got your wedding present. He pulled out a brown package from inside his jacket. But I didn't get you one, I protested as he took Honey and handed me the gift. Open it, Jackson pushed. Carefully, I unwrapped a book of collected poems by Yeats. Thank you. It's beautiful. I rubbed my fingers over the gray buckram and beveled edges, traced the title on the leather label. It'll be the perfect start for a library, Cousin Mary. Library, I whispered, awed by his love of books. Our library. He opened the collection to the title page, looked at me, and read the inscription he'd written along with a verse from one of Yeats's poems underneath. For my dear bride and bookwoman, Cussie Mary Lovett, October 20, 1936. And shy as a rabbit, helpful and shy, to an isle in the water, with her I would fly. I traced his script with a fingertip to magpie the precious words away to my heart. With him, I would fly wherever the winds might take us. Jackson placed his hand over mine and the book and squeezed. He lifted us down from the buckboard wagon, tethered the horse to a post, then carried Honey in one arm and looped his other around mine. Harriet and Eula stepped outside the center, their faces flushed, eyes straining. I'd never told them my business, and they'd never cared to ask. Still grieving Pa, I hadn't come to the center in September and stuck to my book route. And when October rolled around, I'd missed the center again after Honey fell ill with a fever. Mindful, I'd followed the WPA's regulations and made up those two missed days with weekend book deliveries. Jackson turned his head to the library ladies, grinned wide, pausing to tip his dandy new felt hat. Ladies, it's a fine morning. I looked up at his joyful eyes. Yes, ma'am, a mighty fine day to marry Troublesome's finest gal, Jackson practically crowed. Harriet and Eula had their hands planted to their chests, mouths agape, inviting flies. Honey pulled off her new bonnet, and I tied it back onto her head, swept a kiss across her chubby, sweet cheek. Eula's face softened a little at that. She took out a handkerchief from a pocket and dabbed it over her eyes and pressed it to her nose. Harriet elbowed her sharply and whispered something. Flustered, Eula leaned away and shook her head. Then Harriet hollered, "Blew it!" She raised her arm, waved. "Blew it, you missed 2 days at the center." She stepped off the stoop. "You be here Monday and on time. You'll be crating books all day and the next for Orin." I was delighted to hear they'd hired Mr. Taft, and it didn't bother me none to do the heavy lifting. I'd do their work all day, every day, as long as I had the books and spent my nights with Jackson. I glanced up at him and warmed in anticipation of our first night. Jackson felt it too. I caught the yearning in his bright eyes and saw his love would be tender and beautiful. "Blew it! 7 sharp, not a minute later!" Harriet snipped, her order bouncing down the street. Jackson turned and in a smooth voice said, "I'll make sure my bride's not late." Then he winked in a shameless manner at the library ladies before pulling me into a fiery public kiss. Honey squealed, and Jackson pecked her cheek and released me, both of us reluctant to part. Harriet gasped and worked a silent, sassing mouth. The two women stretched their necks our way and locked eyes with me, a mix of wonderment, surprise. Then Harriet whispered again to Eula, but the head librarian wagged her head and disappeared back inside. Harriet stomped off toward the dry goods, her angry skirts scattering leaves. Jackson led us inside the courthouse and down the hall to a small office. "It's the wedding couple," Mr. Dalton, the banker and Jackson's friend, called out a cheerful greeting. He looked dapper in his suit. Doc stepped forward and kissed my cheek, thumped Jackson lightly on the back. "What a pretty bride, Blewett. A blessed day for a wedding indeed." The officiant slipped a finger under his bow tie, straightening the band. In a minute, his wife came into the room with a Bible. "Good morning. I hope I didn't keep you," she said, her eyes darting over the faces before landing on mine. "Ah, good morning, Margie. Meet our lovely couple, Jackson and Cussie," the justice said. Margie murmured a shy hello. She opened the Bible, found a page, then passed it to her husband and took the spot beside him. The justice said, "We are gathered before God and man today to join this couple in holy matrimony." Honey rested her head on Jackson's shoulder, and he reached for my hand. A sharp rap on the door interrupted, and coal miner Howard Moore poked his head inside. "Pardon, sir, but I need you to stop the ceremony." "What's the nature of this?" the justice scowled. "This is a legal and holy matrimony." A chorus of fizzling gasps crawled around the warm room. Jackson tensed, and I gripped his hand in a dampening clasp. "Take your leave," Doc demanded and squeezed up front, glaring hotly at the miner. Mr. Moore shook his head. "I need to have a word with the officiant. It's mighty important. Won't take long." He twisted his hat in a hand, anxious. The justice quickly excused himself and left the room. Doc leaned in between us, wrapped his arms over our shoulders, and whispered, "I'm sure Justice will be right back and will have you married within the hour." He nodded firmly and took his place close behind us. We stared at the door, watching. Honey fidgeted in the heat, wriggled in Jackson's arms. The air felt like it had wrapped the room in molasses. When the justice returned a few minutes later, Mr. Moore and two other miners who had brought Pa home that August night pushed into the room with us. "Cussie," the justice said, "the men have something important to ask of you." The miners were pink-faced and scrubbed, with worn hats clasped to their bellies, dressed in clean but coal-stained work breeches and pressed shirts. Puzzled, I murmured my consent, and Mr. Moore stepped forward. "Ma'am, Miss Cussie, the last words of your dear pap was for you. He asked that I stand in his place should this marriage come to pass. And I promised I would. And if it's all right with you, Miss Cussie, I'd sure like to keep my word and see you knotted and done right. Be honored to give you away, ma'am." "Yes," I barely breathed.
"Very good, Mr. Moore," the justice said. "We can now begin the ceremony with your passage."
Mr. Moore took the empty spot by my side, pulled out a tattered piece of paper, and said, "Elijah asked me to read this, Song of Songs 8:6. And very carefully, Mr. Moore did. "Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death, its jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame," the coal miner read. Slowly, I turned to Mr. Moore and saw Pa there with his burning candle, speaking through him. The ceremony didn't last more than 5 whirlwind minutes and came to a close when Jackson kissed me and the justice of the peace pronounced us Mr. and Mrs. Lovett and kindly added, "And Miss Honey Lovett." A flurry of kisses, congratulations, and pats on backs passed around the stuffy room. Outside, I was surprised to see Birdie with her boy waiting on the courthouse steps. R.C. and his young bride stood beside them, and Martha Hannah, Devil John, and the youngins lingered nearby, along with a few other curious bystanders. A secret flickered in Jackson's eyes.
"Did you invite these folks?" I asked.
"I may have mentioned the wedding to a few when I was clearing your paths, checking on your route."
I was thrilled that he wanted my patrons here for me, even more that he'd taken over what Pa'd done, clearing the briars and brush trails to keep me and Junior safer. I spied Timmy Flynn and his mama standing back in the little crowd. Timmy ran up to me, handed me a scraggly daisy and hugged my waist before disappearing behind his mama's skirts. Small cheers and well wishes lifted into the air as my patrons gathered around to watch us depart. Jackson helped us onto the wagon. A young man limped over and introduced himself as Alonzo, Loretta Adams' nephew. He reached up to hand me a bulky package. "Aunt Retta sent me to deliver a gift. God bless you, Mr. and Mrs. Lovett." His greeting was slowed with whiskey. "Thank you for coming, Alonzo." I passed Honey to Jackson and opened the present. It was a neatly folded calico quilt with colors of many hues. Miss Loretta's note read, "October 20, 1936. Child, may your union blossom and your lives be filled with all the precious colors of God's glorious fabrics. Your library patron, Miss Loretta Adams." I looked at Jackson and our beautiful child, then turned my gaze toward the colorful Kaintuck Mountains and back to my precious patrons, feeling blessed by the glorious tapestry they had given me, by their lives that enriched mine. I didn't want to leave, needed to give my thanks, linger and share this moment, this time with each of them. I loved these folks, and for the very first time, I felt them loving me back. From behind, I heard someone call for Jackson. Once, then more urgent.
"Hold up, Lovett."
It was Sheriff and his deputy, and they looked agitated. Doc followed close on their heels, his face just as red. Jackson handed Honey back up to me. A door creaked open, and Harriet stepped out of the library center and folded a smugness into her crossing arms. Confused, I searched the faces of the lawmen, stiffened atop the wagon seat.
"Davies Kimbo, you have no qualms with these good folks."
Doc rushed up to Jackson's side. Most of my patrons milled about and stared, straining to hear. Sheriff Kimbo ignored the doc. Despite the cool fall day, Honey's face grew flushed and a fussy whine rose from her. I patted, rubbed her back with my darkening hand, jiggling her on a knee.
"Jackson Lovett, you're under arrest," Sheriff said.
Jackson spun around, puzzlement crawling into his bright eyes.
"What? What's the meaning of this?" Jackson demanded. "Miscegenation laws. Kentucky law says intermarriages between Negroes or persons of color in Kentucky are prohibited and punishable," Sheriff clipped.
"That's absurd," Doc said. "Your kin, Charlie, sure enough married her, Kimbo."
"Blewett can't marry again," Sheriff said flatly. "The law was revised this June, and it now states clearly and includes any color, any mix."
A bigger crowd gathered, pushed forward, closer now. Someone yelled, "Lock them sinners up, immoral!" Another cried, "No!" And one more shouted, "Heathens!" I gasped. It had never happened here, but I'd read about the laws in the city newsprints and knowed they were being enforced in other places. Folks were charged and thrown in jail for courting someone not like themselves, for taking another color to their marriage beds. It was an ugly law that let mere folk lord over different type folks, decide who a person could or couldn't love.
"You got no quarrel with me, Sheriff," Jackson said, dismissing him and lifting a foot to get into the wagon.
Sheriff shifted and squared his shoulders.
"The law clearly states that marrying a colored destroys the very moral supremacy of our godly people and is damning and destructive to our social peace."
"I'm taking my wife and daughter home," Jackson told the sheriff. "You listen to me, Lovett. You think you can just waltz back into Kaintuck with your highfalutin ways and soil the good people? No, sir, this ain't the West." Sheriff's face heated with a fury. The crowd's voices rose like a swarm of angry bees. Honey startled with a whimper and rubbed her tearing eyes. Again, I patted her back and clutched her closer to me.
"That's right," someone in the crowd punched the holler. "They ought to be horsewhipped," another bellowed. "Ain't natural. Ain't right, Sheriff."
"Shut your mouth, Horace. You ain't right in the head," another lashed back.
"You best come peacefully, Lovett," the deputy warned.
Mr. Dalton pushed through the crowd and said,
"I will have you answering to Mayor Gibson for this, Davies Kimbo."
He turned and made his way back to the courthouse.
"Stop this foolishness, Sheriff," Doc said loudly. No law has been broken. A simple pill can turn Blewett white. A hush fell over Troublesome, and then another buzz climbed into the air and seemed to deafen me, making me lightheaded. Someone looked up at me and pointed. Others wagged tongues to their closest neighbor. Honey buried a sob against my chest, and I tried to speak softly to her above my own loud heartbeats. It's the truth, Davies, Doc said. Sheriff glanced at me, unsure, then shook his head and said, That's hogwash, Thomas, and you can save it for the judge. He's being lawfully charged for fornication and the unlawful marriage and cohabitation with a colored and mixed citizen. Fornication. Dumbfounded, I opened and closed my mouth, and the scratched denials trickled out. No, no, Jackson's voice toppled mine. Go to hell, Kimbo. Damn it, Doc's curse laddered atop of Jackson's. It's lawful, and I'll attest Blewett has a medical condition and can be treated with pills. It's true, Sheriff. R.C. stepped forward and tucked his head. Yes, sir, it is. Seen it for myself. Miss Blewett, bookwoman, was a what for my very eyes. She's a goddamn colored, Sheriff turned and told the stirring crowd. A man and woman jeered. Another gasped. Again, Honey fussed and squirmed in my arms, and I tried to rock her. Jackson glanced up at us, his face rigid with grief, worry, and a hint of something troubling. I seen it, Sheriff, and so did my Ruth, R.C. said, quiet but insistent. You get on back to your fire tower, lad, or I'll see to you fighting a bigger fire with them wimped park ranger bosses of yours, Sheriff barked. A few folks guffawed. R.C. flinched, and his freckled face turned penny orange. Doc cursed and then pleaded. Davies, she's a decent woman, for God's sakes. Sheriff cut an eye to me. I know Blewett's a good enough lass, but she's a colored one just the same. He shot out an accusing arm to me. And I know damn well you already attested to her being a fit body and sound mind. Harriet stepped out of the crowd to glare, and I dropped my gaze, remembering Doc had told her just that. Doc looked to Harriet and the sheriff, studying, then turned back to the assistant supervisor, a contempt rising in his wrinkled brow. Harriet's cold eyes filled with defiance, and she tilted a triumphant chin skyward. Jackson's eyes tightened, and he tossed his hat into the back of the wagon and loosened the collar on his freshly pressed shirt. Doc shook his head. She's not colored. I've told you, it's a medical ailment, and... She sure enough is, Sheriff thundered. An ailment on these good folks. Step aside, man. We're lawfully married, Sheriff. Jackson fished into his pocket and pulled out the folded marriage license and flicked it open. I tried to speak, but the words thickened in my throat, smothering. Honey squalled, and I lowered her onto the boards with shaky hands, trying to calm her so I could go to my husband. She quieted some, and I climbed down and went to Jackson's side. A few of my patrons lifted their voices. He's right. Let him go. Leave them in peace, Sheriff. One man called out from the back of the crowd, and I could tell it was Devil John. Best move along, Devil. Lessen you be thirsting for something a little harder than what you can swallow. Or are you wanting to spend more time with me again and let your paying customers go thirsty? Sheriff shouted. A few snickers floated in the air. Devil John took a hard step forward, but Martha Hannah grabbed hold of his sleeve, whispered into his ear. This is a sham, and I'm taking my bride home. Let's go, Cussy Mary. Jackson reached for my arm. It's the law, and the law says she's just another nigger. Sheriff spit and grabbed Jackson's sleeve. The words lay thick atop the crowd's energetic whispers. Then Harriet's hisses reached my ears. A damnation, sinners. Jackson growled a low curse and leaned in toward the sheriff, then swung, and his fist landed square on the lawman's face. The marriage license floated to the ground. Sheriff's head snapped, and he turned partway, wiped his cracked lips, and spit out blood. The deputy flew to Jackson's backside, latched hold of his arms, locking him in a hug. Sheriff drew back an arm and punched Jackson in the gut and thrust another to his head and one more to his middle. I cried out for Jackson. Doc gripped hold of my arm and yanked me back. Deputy shoved Jackson forward.
Jackson staggered, and I screamed and broke free of Doc just as my husband slumped to the ground. I bent down to Jackson, but the deputy stepped in front of me. Doc cursed and rushed over. "Stop this, Davies! Stop, I say!" "Take the wagon, cussy," Jackson rasped as he tried to pull himself up to his knees. "I'll..." He pressed a hand to his side. "I'll be along shortly." Doc laid a concerned hand on Jackson's shoulder, but he shrugged him off and took a breath, blood trickling from his brow. He got partway up when Sheriff swung his boot, kicked him in the side, and once again in the gut. Jackson crumpled to the ground, struggled to rise to his knees. Sheriff got in one more hard kick. "Lie still," Sheriff ordered. Jackson's jaw folded and smacked the earth, a flurry of dust rising. Then the deputy hefted a boot and brought it down on Jackson's leg. I heard a sickening sound of bone shatter fold into Jackson's scream, his cry echoing mine. From the crowd, a single applause lifted and several protests rose, but no one dared step forward. Jackson stretched out his arm and tried to pick up the dirt-stained marriage license near him, leaving a bloody print on the paper. "I said, lie still, boy, lessen you want to end up as just another dead nigger lover." Sheriff drew his gun from the holster. "Get on home, folks, before I lock you up for meddling with the law." A few of the townsfolk slowly turned away, taking their leave, their grumbles falling into purring whispers. Jackson moaned. Sheriff pointed the gun at him. "No, please don't hurt him." I dropped beside Jackson, huddled over him, begging. "Please, Sheriff, we don't mean any harm. Just let us go." Jackson grunted one last time and passed out. I cradled his face. "Jackson, wake up! Wake up!" Sheriff holstered his gun, then knocked my thigh with his boot, leaving a dirt stain on my wedding dress. "Get on." A war cry erupted, and RC came charging at the lawman, half-bent, his head aimed toward the sheriff's belly. But Sheriff had a bigger might, swiftness over the young boy, and grabbed RC by the shoulders and flung him to the ground. The lawman planted a boot on the boy's chest. "You assault me ever again, fireboy, and you'll be sitting in a prison cell if I don't stomp you down into the fires of hell first." RC knocked his leg away, rolled over, and rose. You keep your stinking hands off, bookwoman!" Ruth cried out for RC, rushed up and dragged him away. "Blewett," Sheriff said, "you go on, girl. Take that colored babe of yours back to your holler before I arrest you or worse." The sky seemed to tilt, and the earth moved as I squeezed my burning eyes and looked up at him. "Worse." Pa's words struck like a cold steel blade. "Blues, many a colored have been hanged for less." "Someone fetch my bag," Doc hollered as he folded his coat under Jackson's head and worried his healing hands over Jackson's busted bones. A wail struck high, pierced and melded into old Kentucky winds, sweeping it into the pines, rattling me. I came to my senses and recognized Honey's cries. "I've got him, Blewett. Give me room," Doc said. I rose, my legs near folding, my arms reaching to the wagon for support. I looked back at my battered husband and my heart ached, weighed heavy like stone. Sheriff moved closer to Jackson and nodded to his deputy. "Let's get him up and over to the jail. Doc can tend to him there." The deputy motioned to two men. They lifted Jackson up and carried him across the street to jail, Doc fussing and following closely behind them. Sheriff rubbed his hurting jaw, lightly touched his crooked nose. He winced, then spoke low. "I'm letting you go, Blewett, because of Elijah and the sacrifices he made for the good miners here. And I know how easily Lovett could have tricked a simple-minded Blue." I stared at the sheriff, stunned. Honey's whimpers turned into a mournful wail, and I heard my family's burdens, their struggles, and the unspeakable horrors they had bore in the child's heartbreaking cries. A blinding fury balled into angry fists, and I drew a fire from it and raised a darkening hand. "Pa was your minor's sacrifice, you mule," I said, locking eyes with the lawman. "And my good pa and many a good Blue made sacrifices so you and your kin wouldn't have to." I looked out into the crowd. "So you and your white families would be safe, have the protection, the life we never had. the life you take for granted. The disgust rose high in my voice, straining ugly and thin. Murmurs rose from the hill folk, and I saw the truth of my words reflected in solemn faces. Sheriff cast his eyes downward, nudged the marriage license with his toe, then brought his heel down, ripping it in half.
The law says we're done. Now don't let me catch you loitering around here again unless you're on book business.
Our marriage had been halved as easily as an apple, and the split cast an unbearable grief across my heart.
Get on, Blewett, for I arrest you and send that afflicted babe over to Frankfort, to the home of the idiots,
Sheriff said with a finality that hung in the air. My baby, I said in a voice so small it was lost to the wind. Shaken, I gripped the wagon rail and glanced inside at the teary-eyed child lying on the planks. Honey stretched out her arms for me, hiccuping between whimpers. He would do it. Send her to the old asylum for feeble-minded and idiot children. The horrid place for the demented or different youngins nobody wanted. I felt my knees sag. Fear punched at my insides, twisted, leaving me weak and sickened. Devil John brushed angrily past the sheriff to my side.
The election's just 3 weeks away, Davies Kimbo, and I'll sure enough enjoy spending my time seeing you ousted. The town will have your badge for this, your livelihood.
Chants rumbled from the crowd and turned into a roar. Take his badge! Take his badge! Hearing the protests, Harriet spun on her heels and fled over to the center. Eula burst out the door and blocked Harriet. The head librarian's face writhed with rage, her words and talking hands flying hot and fast at her simpering assistant. Badge, badge, the crowd thundered, their chants pounding down the dusty street, rising up into Troublesome's ageless, tree-thick crags. Sheriff stepped backward and placed a curling palm over his holstered gun.
Get on home, folks, before I throw the lot of you in jail.
The deputy edged closer to him and gripped his gun, his eyes nervously darting around.
You heard him. Move along. Now.
Folks quieted and slowly parted.
I can tote you and the babe safely home, bookwoman, Devil John offered.
I shook my head and grabbed the wagon seat. Sheriff turned his back to me, signaled for the deputy to unfetter our horse from its post.
Get on back to where you belong, girl.
He raised his hand and flicked a dismissal.
Where the law and God sees it fit for your kind.
I glanced down at the tattered, blood-stained marriage license. Numb, I pulled myself atop the wagon. There was nothing more to be said. The sheriff, God, and Kentucky had said it for me. It had been foolish to dream. I snapped the reins. Dreams were for books. Chapter 47. November 27, 1940. Dear Queenie, thank you for the books. My patrons were thrilled to receive them. I was pleased to learn of your grand news that the education in librarianship is nearing completion and your graduation is almost here. Librarian! It seems only yesterday when you left Troublesome. I am happy your family is well and pleased to inform you we are fit too. I'm much obliged for the new book you sent Honey for her 4th birthday. It's one of her favorites. She demands I read it to her at first light and every night, and insists I call her May Lee. Yesterday, my daughter declared she will be a librarian, and I dream it for her. The new library building is coming along, and soon Troublesome will open its first borrowing branch. Last month, I received an invitation from the Kentucky Federation of Women's Clubs in Louisville and was given an award for outstanding service and dedication to the Pack Horse Project. Much to my surprise and Harriet's loud protests, when I returned to the center, Eula quietly took down the no-colored sign and tossed it out into the trash. Jackson is doing well, though I fear he still suffers from the beatings and hasn't fully healed since his release from prison. He has been looking for a place for us up north near Makes Creek in Ohio. He learned the community is also in dire need of the Pack Horse Librarian services. Mr. Dalton has been most generous. Since one of the conditions of Jackson's release was that he cannot re-enter Kentucky for 25 years, he has been helping us out and was finally able to privately sell the last tract on Lovett Mountain.
though Davies Kimbo was voted out and never re-elected. I've been told he watches around town for Jackson's return and has made it his moral duty to keep him banned. We pray that the laws of the land will change to favor all unions, all folks one day. I remain hopeful for our safety and our future. I must close for now and pass this to Mr. Taft so that he can post it safely over to War Branch for me tomorrow. Give my best to Willow and the boys. Write to me soon. Your friend, Cussie Mary.
Mama, I want to read the book Miss Retta gave me, Honey called out.
I raised the tip of the pencil and paused at my signature and pulled my gaze up from the letter, the brown parchment buckling, rippling under my hand. Honey held up the colorful storybook, The ABC Bunny. A crooked smile sat soft on her pale blue face, brightening the shadow-darkened cove and warming our cabin that Pod built for me and Mama long ago.
I read you a happy story, Mama. Honey hoisted the book higher. About Bunny making different friends. About Kitten, Bunny Frog, and... Oh, Porcupine! She marched over to me.
Books will learn you, Mama.
I'm Bookwoman, and I read you this one.
Come on, little Bookwoman. Let's read on the porch while your Mama finishes her letter, Jackson said to Honey and lightly squeezed my shoulder. He'd be gone back to the Tennessee hills before sunrise, but couldn't get enough of Honey, or me, of him, on these precious secret visits. I tilted my chin up to meet his eyes.
I want to hear our happy story. Jackson's gaze lingered briefly on mine, and then he scooped up a squealing Honey and carried her outside.
Read to me, little bookwoman, he sang out.
Read your papa the happy story.
My heart lifted, and I smoothed down the thick paper with my palm and pinned Love It to my signature with a hope-filled prayer. Author's note. Inspired by the true and gentle historical blue-skinned people of Kentucky and the brave and dedicated Kentucky Packhorse librarians born of Roosevelt's New Deal acts, The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek showcases a fascinating and important footnote of history. In writing the novel, my hope was to humanize and bring understanding to the gracious blue-skinned people of Kentucky, to pay tribute to the fearsome packhorse librarians, and to write a human story set in a unique landscape. Methemoglobinemia is the extremely rare disease that causes skin to be blue. In the United States, it was first found in the Fugates of Troublesome Creek in eastern Kentucky. In 1820, Martin Fugate, a French orphan, came to Kentucky to claim a land grant on the banks of Troublesome Creek in Kentucky's isolated wilderness. Martin married a full-blooded, red-headed, white-skinned Kentuckian named Elizabeth Smith. Martin and Elizabeth had no idea what awaited them. They had 7 children, and out of those, 4 were blue. It was against all odds that, oceans away, Martin would find a bride who carried the same blue blood recessive gene. Methemoglobinemia is most commonly acquired from heart disease, or airway obstruction, or taking too much of certain drugs. When acquired, it can be life-threatening. The Fugates' methemoglobinemia, however, was congenital. Most of the Fugates lived a very long life, into their 80s and 90s, and without serious illnesses related to their blue skin. Congenital methemoglobinemia is due to an enzyme deficiency, leading to higher than normal levels of methemoglobin in the blood, a form of hemoglobin that overwhelms the normal hemoglobin, which reduces oxygen capacity. Less oxygen in the blood makes it a chocolate brown color instead of red, causing the skin to appear blue instead of white. Doctors can diagnose congenital methemoglobinemia because the color of the blood provides the clue. The mutation is hereditary and carried in a recessive gene. I've modified one historical date in the story so I could include relevant information about medical aspects and discoveries. Instead of the 1930s, as is the book's era, it was actually in the 1960s when Madison Cawen, MD,
A Kentucky hematologist heard about the blue-skinned people and set out to find them. In the 1940s, a doctor in Ireland made similar discoveries among his people. Dr. Cowan found the fugates tucked in isolated hollers in the thick-treed hills of Appalachia near Ball Creek and Troublesome Creek in Kentucky. The doctor convinced them to let him draw blood, then tested, analyzed, and drew more blood. The fugates were gracious and kind people, according to Dr. Cowan's reports. After testing and research, he discovered the fugates had congenital methemoglobinemia. Cowan first treated the fugates with methylene blue injections that instantly turned their skin white. But the drug was only a temporary fix. Methylene blue, first used to treat cyanide and carbon monoxide poisoning, generally is secreted in the urine within 24 hours and can cause unpleasant side effects in the interim. The doctor left the fugates a generous supply of oral methylene blue tablets to be taken daily. Cowan also became a protector of the fugates, and when news media and Hollywood came to Kentucky to see the rare people, he refused to disclose their whereabouts. With the help of the elder fugates, their Bible notations, and their recollections, Dr. Cowan charted the family and traced their ancestry back to Martin Fugate. In 1943, Kentucky banned first cousin marriages, and the ban continues there and in most other states today. This prohibition in Kentucky was not only to prevent birth defects, it was sought for other reasons as well. The Ku Klux Klan lobbied for the ban early and fought vigorously for the bill's passage to keep white supremacy pure, while others wanted it to keep feuding mountain clans strong, which prevented young lovers from marrying enemy cousins and turning disloyal and increasing a clan's numbers. Anti-miscegenation laws in Kentucky were in effect from 1866 until 1967. For anyone convicted, the penalty was a fine or imprisonment or both. From what we know, the Fugates originated from France and were descendants of French Huguenots. Could the Fugates' medical anomaly mean they were true blue bloods descended from European royals? The Fugates were linked only to inbreeding instead of being embraced for their very uniqueness. Even when first cousin marriages were legal across the United States, the Fugates were shunned and shamed, suffering in isolation because of their skin color and inherited genes. In 1913, the Kentucky Federation of Women's Clubs convinced a local coal baron, John C. Mayo, to subsidize a mounted library service to reach people in poor and remote areas. But a year later, the program expired when Mayo died. It would be almost 20 years until the service was revived. The Packhorse Library Project was established in 1935 and ran until 1943. The service was part of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration, WPA, and an effort to create jobs for women and bring books and reading material into Appalachia, into the poorest and most isolated areas in eastern Kentucky that had few schools, no libraries, and inaccessible roads. The librarians were known as book women, though there were a very small number of men among their ranks. These fearsome Kentucky librarians traveled by horse, mule, and sometimes foot, and even rowboat to reach the remotest areas, in creeks and up crags, into coves, disconnected pockets, and black forests, and to towns named Hell for Certain, Troublesome, and Cutchin, sometimes traveling as much as 100 or more miles a week in rain, sleet, or snow. Packhorse librarians were paid $28 a month and had to provide their own mounts. Books and reading materials and places for storing and sorting the material were all donated and not supplied by the WPA's payroll. With few resources and little financial help, the Packhorse librarians collected donated books and reading materials from the Boy Scouts, PTAs, women's clubs, churches, and the State Health Department. The librarians came up with ingenious ways to provide more reading resources, such as making scrapbooks with collected recipes and house cleaning tips that the mountain people passed on to them in gratitude for their service. The book women colored pictures to make children's picture books, journals, and more,
all the while vigorously seeking donations. Despite the financial obstacles, the harshness of the land, and the sometimes fierce mistrust of the people during the most violent era of Eastern Kentucky's history, the packhorse service was accepted and became dearly embraced. These clever librarians turned their traveling library program into a tremendous success. In the years of its service, more than 1,000 women served in the Packhorse Library Project, and it was reported that nearly 600,000 residents in 30 Eastern Kentucky counties, considered pauper counties, were served by them. During those years, the beloved program left a powerful legacy and enriched countless lives. Finally, courting candles. The spiral design of courting candles over 100 years ago was likely created to keep the melting candle in place and from slipping, a mere practicality, more folklore than fact, though they certainly could have been used later by a patriarch to teach a daughter to respect his judgment and as a way to screen for potential suitors. Still, I found it a commanding and curious induction of courtship. How powerful that the candle could be the source of someone's lifelong misery or joy, and passed on in different generations. How wonderful the conversations that must have taken place around and over it. A final note. Dearest listener, this is one of the most important books I've written to date. Dear in all ways, loved in a million more. I have tried to present the novel with precise historical backdrops, which involved in-depth research, interviews, meetings with hematologists, doctors, fire watchers, and others, studying Roosevelt's WPA programs, and living in Appalachia. If anything is omitted or befuddles, it is strictly unintended and the fault of me, the author. This concludes the reading of The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek, a novel by Kim Michelle Richardson. Copyright 2019 by Kim Michelle Richardson. This book was read by Katie Shore. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Writer's House, LLC, and was produced in 2019 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.